Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a settlement will provide funding to efforts to clean pollution in the Fox River. We'll talk to a DNR spokesman about the ongoing effort.
First, an article in the Wisconsin High School student newspaper got a lot of attention this week for drawing attention to a perceived rape culture at the school.
But it's drawn attention to another issue, press freedom for student publications, after school administrators instituted new review policies for the paper, in effect taking more control over the content.
We've got two guests with us now to talk about that issue. Fond du Lac High School senior Tanvi Kumar is co-editor-in-chief of Cardinal Columns, the student newspaper, and she wrote the piece at the center of the story. Tanvi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Vince Felak is a professor of journalism at UW Oshkosh, advisor to the student newspaper there. Vince, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Tanvi, let's start with you. Why did you write the piece on rape culture for your high school paper?
I think what I guess I realized was that there is no shortage of rape jokes in our high schools and in our society in general. I mean, a test is hard. Oh, you've gotten raped by the test. A sports team loses to another sports team. Oh, they were raped. And I guess I started wondering, how did survivors of sexual assault feel about the minimization of such horrible things that had happened to them? And I kind of wanted to make sure that they had a platform to speak about these issues.
And I thought I read that there was even a Twitter feed with rape jokes that was originating from someone in the high school.
Yes, there was. There was a Twitter account started by someone in my high school that poked fun of very specific rape incidents that had occurred.
And what was the general reaction after you wrote this piece? What did people say?
The general reaction of the student body has been overwhelmingly positive. Teachers read the articles out loud to their class to allow debate and discussion. Many students came up to me to tell me their stories of sexual assault, and I even had a teacher do the same. So I was surprised by just how powerful it was able to be.
When did you hear about the response from your school administration?
A month after we published it.
And what changed under their new guidelines? What's different now?
What's different now is that our principal and our superintendent will have the final say in whatever we choose to publish. If they deem something to be poorly written or unsuitable for immature audiences, they can take it out, as well as many other requirements that they've created with the new policy.
And the school superintendent issued the statement in response to questions from the Fond du Lac reporter. He said, "I believe that the guidelines are a reasonable expectation for a school-sponsored publication. The district has a responsibility to protect the educational process, environment, and the interests of all students." Tanvi, what do you think about that? Does that sound, as he says, reasonable to you?
I guess it is reasonable to some extent. What I don't understand is how this article or anything we've published in the past has disrupted the educational process. I mean, I feel that as a result of this, a new approach has been taken to education on social issues in our high school.
Let's bring Vince Felak, a journalism professor at UW Oshkosh, in now. What do you think of the school's response to the piece Tanvi was just talking about?
I think that they're really overreaching in a lot of ways. I think that they are trying to implement a culture of censorship in the attempt to stop things that they don't like. One of the earliest comments on this was that, you know, the Cardinal Columns needs to publish more positive stories, which is usually administrative code for stop writing about stuff that we don't want to see. And that concept in and of itself is right at the core of censorship.
And this has been in the courts before. What is the legal standard on this, the bar for determining if the school should restrict content in a student publication?
The legal standing is a case from about 1988 called Hazelwood v. Kuhlmeier. And the basis of it says that the principals or the administration do have the ability to restrict free speech or free press if they can demonstrate that it basically limits, and this is why they're using the language they're using, that it limits the educational endeavors of the school. In other words, if they can show that the the publication of this will pretty much grind the school to a halt. But there are two things to keep in mind. One is that it says that they can restrict. It doesn't say that they have to or that they should. And the second is that that's a pretty high bar that's set. But what you realize is that this is being applied all over the place with a kind of a wide brush just to get rid of content that people don't like. One case that's going on right now is in, I know Student Press Law Center is working on that as well as this one, and it's in Arkansas where a student's profile was removed from the yearbook because the student was gay. And the principal said that this, again, it follows the whole Hazelwood playbook, which says, you know, this will definitely restrict the educational opportunities of our students, but they won't say how or why. So that's kind of where you sit with this from both a legal and an opportunistic standpoint.
Vince, in the world of student newspapers at high schools, even at colleges, is this a constant battleground over what they can publish, how much say the administration has, or are these cases few and far between?
There's a lot of this, and you know, we're not the first out here in Wisconsin, and we won't be the last, unfortunately. And I think that a lot of times what you see are people kind of couching this in the idea of oversight, or, you know, we just want to make sure everything's okay. But at the end of the day, no matter what kind of fuzzy term they use to try to help themselves sleep better at night, the fact of the matter is they're saying, I don't like this, so you can't publish it and other people can't see it. And that's the core of what censorship really is.
Tanvi, I understand this hasn't just been a response that's isolated to the high school, that it's something that has had ripples out into the community. What are people in the community saying about this?
I mean, obviously, it's not just our community. This issue has drawn national attention. We've had several national media outlets cover this story, but the entire environment right now is very supportive, and I think the whole town has kind of come behind this issue, and I think they're really trying to increase the collaboration on issues like these.
And I know there's a petition drive online, but I gather there was some response from some of the faculty at your school as well.
Right. We have a petition on change.org, and it has now received 5,000 signatures. Also, our entire English department sent in about a 22-page petition to our school board to reverse this policy, and I think that's just tremendous. I think that is a symbol of how much our teachers truly care about our education.
Well, we're talking right now to Fond du Lac High School student journalist Tanvi Kumar and UW Oshkosh journalism professor Vince Filok about an article Tanvi wrote in the school paper that turned into a press freedom issue. And as we just heard, it's gotten national attention both in Fond du Lac and the state and beyond.
You can join the program. Did you or do you work on a student publication at the high school or college level? Were there ever conflicts with the school administration? On the flip side, do you work at a school? What kind of oversight do student newspapers need? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We're continuing our conversation now about student journalism and press freedom. We've got Fond du Lac High School senior Tanvi Kumar with us. Her piece on rape culture in the student newspaper led to new guidelines from the school administration and accusations of censorship. Vince Filok is also with us. He's a professor of journalism at UW Oshkosh.
You can join in the show. Have you been following this story? What are your thoughts? Do you have experience working on a student newspaper at the high school or college level? Did you see these kind of conflicts over what you could and couldn't publish without input, oversight from school administration? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tanvi, one thing I wanted to ask you about, now under this current policy, more higher-ups have some say in what the content is, but was there some kind of faculty or staff advisor who, you know, was watching, reviewing your work as you went along, even before the new system?
Yes, actually, we have a wonderful advisor, Mr. Matt Smith, and nothing goes in the paper without his approval and without a lot of collaboration with him.
And have there been incidences in the past where someone wanted to publish something and maybe your advisor that you just mentioned said, you know what, this is not, you know, appropriate, or we need to rework this? Has he been active in figuring out what is appropriate for the content?
Of course, all the time. Actually, we had a picture on our inside cover of our magazine, which depicted a survivor of sexual assault laying lifeless among boxes. That actually became a pretty controversial bit to pick with the administration. But he said that we should not use that image because what we wanted to do was Photoshop the words fragile on the boxes. And he said that I don't agree with the notion that survivors of sexual assault are fragile. So ultimately, we didn't include that picture.
Vince Tanvi mentioned earlier that this has been an issue in the wider community, and she says they've gotten a lot of support there for the paper. Is that common for these issues to really spill out beyond the school, or do they just tend to stay in the school and maybe move into the court system?
It usually depends on the case, and it usually also depends on, you know, the quality of the work. I mean, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I think Tanvi's piece was phenomenal. It's probably one of the best pieces of journalism I've read out of high school, and, you know, I kind of teased a little bit when I saw her at the school board meeting. I said, "Are you sure you don't want to come to Oshkosh? You know, we might be able to, you know, squeeze you in for next year to get you in the journalism program there." It's usually the cases where somebody writes something satirical or somebody publishes something that is libelous or somebody, you know, that's when that really lack of support comes out from the community, because they can kind of look at that and say, yeah, we definitely don't want something like this, you know, happening around here. But when it's a good, strong piece of journalism, that's when a lot of communities step up and say, wait a minute, you know, just because you don't like to see it doesn't necessarily make it something that shouldn't be seen.
And we have a caller on the line now. Let's go to Rachel in Milwaukee. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a alma mater of Fondy High School and used to be the editor of the Fondy Free Press, now on my own. But I wanted to call and say thanks, first of all, for writing the article. But I think it's great that this has turned into a freedom of the press issue. But maybe what's more important is to why why it felt like this was, why the administration at Fondy felt like this was an article to be kind of hushed down in the first place or silenced, given that the article is very well written, beautiful article written about how women feel like they aren't allowed to talk about rape at Fondy High.
Okay, well, Rachel, thank you so much for calling. And it's interesting that you're a past alum of that paper as well. And I wonder, she's asking about the silencing that she thinks is going on around rape culture and what the grounds from the administration is for being concerned about this. Vince, can you articulate a little bit more what the concerns might have been surrounding this?
Honestly, I think it comes down to the topic itself. And this is, of course, just purely my own sense of what it is, but the word rape and the word joke showed up in the school newspaper, and somebody in the administration probably freaked out and said, you need to get a handle on these kids. I've had that happen at various other places where I've worked, even at the college level, where somebody saw, you know, they didn't read the whole story, or they didn't, you know, pay enough attention to the whole piece. They just saw something that made them kind of, you know, twitchy and decided that, you know, okay, wait a minute, let's not look at this stuff anymore. We can't have this anymore. And I think, you know, quite frankly, Tanvi's piece is so well done that they really can't say, well, you know, a lot of times people will say, you know, the journalism is bad, or, you know, there are other views or something like that. I mean, this is a rock solid airtight piece. So instead they say, you know, and I think I've heard this before, and Tanvi can correct me if I'm wrong, administrators said, you know, there's nothing wrong with this article per se. You know, we just don't like some of the descriptors, or, you know, the photo might have been a little iffy or whatever. Well, again, that comes down to what the students decide with their advisor, as opposed to, you know, maybe somebody shouldn't see this at all.
Tanvi, were those some of the objections that you heard, or did you not hear the direct objections?
See, I heard some of that. It was never made clear to me what exactly they would not include had this story been written at the time of this new policy. I did hear that, you know, it might have been too graphic, or the statistical research. I think that I said 80% of Fond du Lac High School students have heard a rape joke in the past month, because I did do some statistical research on that, and that number seemed shockingly high to the administration, And they wondered if it was really accurately representing our school as a whole.
Thanks for the call and bringing that up at 800-642-1234. You can join in talking about press freedom for school newspapers, student newspapers. Do you have experience on one of those papers around the state, around the country? If you're at a school, where do you think the line should be drawn? How much oversight does a student paper need at the high school or college level? The number is 800-642-1234.
And we have an email here from Jill in Milwaukee who says, while at Eisenhower High School in New Berlin in the late in the 1990s, I wrote an opinion piece for the school newspaper, and it was on the distribution of condoms in school. Our principal was concerned until I showed him examples of similar articles from school papers across the country. We agreed that I would take any parent complaints, and there were none. So, again, a topic that could be seen as sort of provocative, but in that case, the principal and the student journalist working through it together, is that, do you think, a model, Vince, for a different type of policy? If there needs to be one beyond the paper advisor, could it be a collaboration between the student journalist and the principal?
I think so. I like that email because it issues exactly what, you know, we've been saying for quite some time at both the college and the high school level, which is if you give the students the responsibility and you give them the rights, they usually do a very good job. In other words, if it seems like they have to kind of sneak around, so to speak, because somebody's going to censor them otherwise, that's when more bad things happen. But if you say, hey, look, run what you want to, but keep in mind that you're going to be responsible for whatever happens out of it, in most cases, the students make very smart and very mature decisions on what they will and what they won't run. And that's, again, why the advisor's there, to help them work through that process, as opposed to, say, somebody just saying, nope, don't want to see it.
Back to our callers now with Stephen in Dubuque, Iowa. Stephen, hi.
Hi, I was just calling, sort of follows up nicely with what was just mentioned, that there is sort of a natural censorship in the press in terms of what is printed and what is chosen to be printed by the newspaper and the editor. And I sort of wonder why the administration felt like the advisor wasn't maybe or isn't capable of doing a good enough job of doing that censorship on his or her own, and instead wants to take that role on themselves. I don't know if I'd comment on that.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Tanvi, any thoughts on that?
I think I was wondering the same thing, actually. So,
all right, so something that's a question out there. We go next to Heidi in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. I just want to, first of all, salute you for writing an awesome article at this. And last year, I'm editor-in-chief currently of my high school newspaper. And last year, we had dealt with a situation similar to this. The RM County paper had published a very graphic article about a high school rape case on the front cover. And with the permission of our administration and our advisor, my two past editor-in-chiefs were able to write an incredible article about how that's not okay and student rights and rape cases and such. And I think it's incredible that you guys are bringing this up on the news, because it's often not brought up in high school journalism, usually not considered real journalism.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Heidi. And what do you think about that example, Vince?
I think that, again, it's another instance where student journalists are demonstrating that they can do good work, and that when they're given both the rights and the responsibilities, they do exceptionally well with it. But I agree. I read a lot of student newspapers. I judge for the National Scholastic Press Association. I do critiques for them. I've read probably about 250 to 300 newspapers over the past 3 to 4 years that are at the high school level. And, you know, the quality of the journalism that came out of this piece is right up there in the top echelon, because they were given the rights and the responsibilities that go with something like this.
As we come to the end of the show, Vince, can you give us some brief thoughts on how important student publications are in training the journalists of the future?
They're exceptionally important. And the one big reason why I think that this is an important case is because I get the students next at the college level, and in a lot of cases where they have been censored, and a lot of student newspapers do censor, they don't quite know how to act and how to operate as independent journalists, because I don't have any say over content at the college level. That's our philosophy. So, you know, they need to be able to take more responsibility on themselves. So with an opportunity like the one Tanvi has, she has been able to take that next step and do very well. And if we don't have people like her out there, I don't really know where this field's going to go.
Well, it's a great time to ask. Tanvi, you're off to college next year, as I understand it. Are you thinking about journalism as a career, and has this experience affected you at all?
Most definitely. I think that this experience gave me a genuine insight into what I love. And I think that it's taught me that free speech has the power to change, the power to reform, and most of all, I think the power to heal. So I'm just really glad that I was able to be a part of that process. A lot of people, you know, they tell me to keep fighting the good fight, but what I say in response is that it's actually the survivors of sexual assault in this case that are fighting the good fight every day when they speak out about things that happen to them.
Tanvi, we'll leave it there. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Tanvi Kumar. She is a senior at Fond du Lac High School, co-editor-in-chief of Cardinal Columns, the student newspaper, and Vince Filog, professor of journalism at UW Oshkosh.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a Wisconsin legend who was one of bicycling's pioneer racers.
But first, four paper companies in northeast Wisconsin reached a settlement with federal, state, and tribal governments over PCB contamination in the Fox River.
The $54.1 million deal comes after months of negotiations and will help support the cleanup and restoration of the Fox River.
Here to talk about how cleanup efforts in the Fox River Valley are going and what still needs to be done is Ed Culhane, communications specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He's public affairs manager for the Northeast Wisconsin office of the DNR. Ed, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, the settlement itself totals about $54.1 million. How much is the overall cost of the Fox River cleanup?
Well, this is a very large cleanup. In fact, it's the largest cleanup of contaminated sediments ever attempted anywhere in the world. And the serious work on this began in 2004, and hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of sediments have been removed. And by the time this is done, it will have cost the responsible parties in excess of $1 billion.
Wow, that's a lot. PCBs now were banned decades ago, right? Why are they still a problem we're dealing with in 2014?
Yeah, what happened was back in the 50s, NCR Corp and a paper company here in Appleton began producing carbonless paper, a specific kind of carbonless paper, and which obviously became widely used. And PCBs were used in that process. And so in the decades that followed, in the 50s and 60s, close to 700,000 pounds of this chemical were discharged into the river as a part of those manufacturing processes. PCBs are hydrophobic, which means they don't like water. They tend to stick to sediments in the mud and clay. And in the river, they resuspend themselves into the environment and into the food chain, where they cause reproductive failures and birth defects in fish-eating mammals and birds. And also are a threat to human health. So this is an effort to, this is about risk management. This is about getting those sediments out of the river and reducing that contamination.
And have we seen signs of that damage to wildlife over the decades there?
Oh, yeah, it's been documented. And now we're seeing early signs that the cleanup is having a beneficial effect. You know, up in Little Lake Butamore, where some of the initial dredging took place, we're seeing reduced levels of PCBs in the fish.
I've heard debates elsewhere in the country over maybe different kinds of pollution in sediment between we've got to dredge, we've got to get it out of there, versus no, don't dredge it, that just stirs it up and gets it more into the food chain. Was that a debate in this case as well?
Oh, yes, very, very much a part of the debate. And actually, the cleanup isn't entirely about dredging. There's sort of three different things that are happening. One is huge amounts of sediment are being dredged and will continue to be dredged for the next 4 years. In addition, there is capping going on. So those sediments that are kind of too deep and are in areas that would be very difficult to get to with dredging equipment, we are doing capping, engineered caps that'll, create a seal, between those contaminations and the food chain. And then also there's some areas where the pollution is at a low enough level that the best thing to do is just to let nature take its course and, gradually, dilute that effect. So, and those areas will be monitored. So, and that's called natural recovery. So there's dredging and there's capping and there's natural recovery.
You mentioned that we're already seeing signs in the wildlife of some improvement. Are we improving as far as are we learning how to clean this up better over this 10-year span?
Oh, sure. You know, and I couldn't speak to all the technical challenges and innovations involved, but certainly the you know the expert companies that are working on this and the DNR engineers and that are working on it have learned every year and have developed more efficient and better ways to do it. And whether it's you know how to dewater the sediments, you know what methods work best for cleaning the water that's been treated and then returning it to the river, you know. But on the other hand, a lot of it is pretty basic. You get it out of the river where it's in the food chain, and you put it into an engineered landfill where nobody can get at it.
And now who are the stakeholders involved in this cleanup? Is this just we're taking money from settlements and hiring private contractors, or is the federal government directly involved? How does that all work?
Well, certainly you hire private contractors. You know, the EPA and the DNR, you know, we don't have dredging equipment, you know, or crews to operate that. So there are contractors who specialize in this kind of work. And the DNR role as the lead agency on the cleanup is to be on the ground and to supervise those plans. Right now, we're very actively involved in planning for the 2014 dredging season, which will begin on April 6th. And so all those plans are made up, and they're very specific, and those get approved and then monitored by the DNR. But, yes, those are private contractors.
How much longer? You said we've been at this about 10 years. How far into the future will these cleanup efforts continue?
We plan to have the dredging and capping done by 2017. And then monitoring will go on indefinitely after that.
So what after the dredging, you'll be monitoring. In theory, if it's all gone well, the monitoring will just be checking in every now and then and saying, yep, the PCB levels are still pretty low.
And we'll be monitoring the levels of PCBs that we find in fish and in birds and in mammals, you know, so and to see if that has the effect that we're looking for, you know, to see that those fish, that those contaminant levels are dropping in the fish and that we can start reducing fish consumption advisories on those game fish. And we hope in the not too distant future to be able to remove some of the advisories on some of those fish.
One thing you'd mentioned I didn't ask about more: human impact of PCBs. Has that been detected in the Fox River area?
Well, I don't know that there's any specific human health studies here. I don't know that there's not, but I'm not aware of any. But PCBs have been linked to reproductive issues in human beings. They are so. It's women of childbearing age are particularly, you know, a group of people that we would be concerned about. The PCBs can act as you know, endocrine disruptors in the body, and they can have an effect on the developing fetus.
You mentioned this is one of the biggest efforts of its kind in the country. Is it being looked on where it is now as a success story, as a win for cleanup?
Well, you know, of course, you know, the proof will be in the pudding once we're done. Certainly this is a, you know, I think we're rounding the final, you know, turn on this cleanup. And this has been an amazing effort. If you think about the financial commitment from the responsible parties and the efforts of the state and federal government to get this cleaned up, the Fox River was the number one contributor of PCBs to Lake Michigan and was one of the more than 30 areas of concern around Lake Michigan, and the biggest. You know, we're going to be cutting down on that source of pollution into Lake Michigan, and so this is really a good news story. And this is, I think, one of the great stages of the cleanup. If you go back into the 50s and in the 60s, this river was so polluted. It had no game fish in it, and if you put your hand in it, you'd get a rash.
Ed, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Ed Culhane with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
Up next, we'll learn about a Wisconsinite who was one of the first bicycle racers.
As spring approaches, we think about hauling out that bicycle and tuning it up for the first ride of the year. It's a tradition that goes back a long way, and from the beginning, Wisconsin has been a hotbed of bicycling.
This month is the anniversary of the birth of a Wisconsinite who was one of the sport's pioneer racers. Here to tell us about Walter Sanger are Nick Hoffman and Jesse Gant, co-authors of the book Wheel Fever. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Jesse, good to have you along, too.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with Wisconsin and its background with bicycling. What made Wisconsin a fertile ground, Jesse, for the bicycle craze?
A lot of the same things that are driving the present interest in cycling and the explosion of interest in the sport drove it back in the late 19th century. Begin with a good natural terrain for the sport. Wisconsin is sort of blessed as being a fairly flat state, no major mountain ranges to pass, and very scenic often, and so a lot of the early writers and travelers through the state noted the natural scenery and the natural topography of the state being really a good thing for the early sport. It's also been home a long time to the manufacturing aspect of the sport. There's been factories producing bikes in Wisconsin since the 1870s and 1880s, and a long tradition of just tremendous enthusiasm among state residents for the bicycle that stretches back 150 years.
And the guy we're going to talk about today is a notable from Wisconsin bicycling history, Walter Sanger. Nick, who was he?
Yeah, Walter Sanger has kind of been lost in history. At the time in the 1890s, when he was at his peak for bicycle racing, he was known internationally as one of the greatest competitors in the sport. We can find his name in Australian, even Jamaican newspapers talking about his exploits on the track.
So what set him apart? What made this guy so famous?
Well, he has a lot of really fun folklore about his story. And when he was a young boy, supposedly he broke horses on his father's farm by bicycle. He would race alongside them to break horses. So he came into bicycle racing at a time when most guys are kind of these skinny, lanky guys. And Walter Sanger was described as being Herculean. He's kind of built like a fullback in the NFL today. So he had this raw strength that just wasn't seen before.
Right. And I looked him up on the internet today. I don't know if it was Wikipedia. He seemed to have enormous thighs, which I suppose is true of most champion bicyclists, but he did look Herculean.
Yeah. He's, again, has a very rare build for that time period in the sport. So much so that he was very famous in his races, that he would hold back until the very last stretch. And then because he had this raw strength, he would try and burst forward ahead of his competitors to the finish line, which worked very well for him.
And Jesse, what were the races like back when Walter Sanger was racing?
Think of a modern sporting event today, a stadium packed with cheering admirers, thousands of people in the grandstands, usually good weather because it's usually a sport that has to have good weather outside in order to work, and sponsorships, lots of corporate interests. You know, Sanger was riding bikes that were produced locally by companies in the state in his name, so he had his own brand bicycles. Just a lot of excitement at these events.
Yeah, there was a meet in Appleton in 1896 that drew over 8,000 spectators. This was the big sport in the state during that period.
Wow. And what kind of bikes were people racing on?
They're racing on drop bar safety bicycles, very similar to what we ride today. And even back then, they were always looking for ways to sort of shortcut the weight of their bicycles. So some of these guys are racing on bamboo frame bicycles like Hughesby Manufacturing in Milwaukee or BB Manufacturing in Racine that had wooden frame bicycles. So they're looking for very light model bicycles like a carbon frame today.
Single speed, massive front gear, high speeds. Yeah.
What does the drop bar part mean?
It's their handlebars. So they're kind of crouched over when they're riding.
And with the horns?
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
Okay. Well, that hasn't changed that much then
At all.
No, the bicycle of the 1890s is very similar to the bicycle of today.
And you said he was famous for having these bursts of speed. How successful was he? Did he always win?
Not always, but eventually people caught on to that tactic. In 1896 in Appleton, there was another very successful racer named Eddie Bald who beats him three times in a row, kind of waiting for that burst of speed. But early on, it really worked well. He won many national and world championships. He would travel overseas to London and won races at London's legendary Herne Hill. So this guy was really traveling all over the world for racing. There was a circuit of professional riders. They would just hop on trains and go from city to city for these big meets.
One of his great triumphs early in his career was a race where he was so far ahead at the end of the race that his pedal fell off, and he managed to get off the bike, hammer it back on, and then finish the race and still win. So this really, you know, built his reputation.
That's
early
amazing. I'm curious about what pro bicycle racers back then wore. What was the apparel like, Jesse?
They're wearing fairly skimpy clothes, like a tank top style suit with shorts. You don't want to create too much drag as you're going down the track.
And there was no spandex.
There's no spandex. So these,
this is pretty close.
So. Yeah, this is probably, I would imagine, a light wool or cotton, mm-hmm. a canvas sort of outfit.
Very colorful. There's, mm-hmm. It's all about the spectacle for early bicycle racing.
And there are images in the books where they're posing, you know, very muscular and looking yeah. very, very manly in their outfits.
Yeah.
So there's that great image of Otto Ziegler on a stand after a race posing with his arms above his head and
flexing.
Yeah, flexing his muscles.
It's interesting because I guess that's a cultural shift. You don't think of bicycle racers as the he-men of sports today.
Yeah, yeah. But back then, they definitely were. But this is a time period when the three big sports are baseball, boxing, and bicycling. And they all overlap very, very much. There were a lot of fights even on the early bicycle tracks. There's a great rivalry between a team called the Milwaukee Push, which was the team for the Milwaukee Wheelmen, and the Chicago Cycling Club. And they would follow each other throughout the Midwest, always looking to go head-to-head. But fights during their races were very common. Walter Sanger, even in one instance on a banked track, actually ran a guy off the track and he died. He ran into, was it a tree or part of the grandstand?
Some terrible accident, but these things happened all the time in these sort of races. They're often
really?
Very brutal.
People died in the races all the time?
Well, high speeds and then terrible crashes involving multiple bicyclists at a time.
Did they wear helmets?
No.
No helmets.
There you go. Yeah. I guess. Is that what it was about? No helmets?
No helmets, yeah. Yeah. It was wasn't even really – well, it was thought of a little bit at the time for those people experimenting with safety, but not those daredevil cyclists who are competing.
So it sounds like they were kind of rowdy, these races.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes they would go on for multiple days. Those famous six-day races were just kind of starting during this time period. But the crowds were very much into it. They were chanting the names of their famous the racers that they were following. It was really a scene.
Oh.
Sanger's chant was, "Who wears the wooden shoes? Wally." And
it's a terrible chant.
It is a really bad chant.
Yeah. So this is a reference to his, you know, physical prowess, the heavy feet, and the power that he's bringing to his races, but also a sort of ethnic slur because he was a German rider, and this was associated with, like, an old world custom of the clogs back in Europe. So
yeah, they all had great nicknames. There was a man named Ted Lawson who was the Terrible Swede. Walter Sanger was the Pride of Milwaukee, Wooden Shoes Sanger. So these guys were really heralded.
One of the Andre brothers was known as the Flying Badger here in Wisconsin.
No, that's a good one. The Flying Badger. So speaking of clogs, what did bike racers wear on their feet?
They're wearing very simple athletic shoes. Some of the guys are already strapping their feet down to the pedals. So again, there's not a lot of changes from that early racing, besides maybe the violence of the sport.
What about women? Were women involved in the scene at all?
So there's a famous example in our book of Green Bay or Appleton. Somewhere.
Green Bay meet, yeah.
Green Bay meet where women racers are holding a women's only race and nobody comes and the prize money is eliminated through corruption, I think, and the hotels are empty in town and it really kind of fails. This is a very sort of masculine sort of world and the male racers draw most of the attention at this time. And that's a long story of exclusion built into cycling from the very start. You know, League of American Women banned women riders for a long time, and were not welcome for quite a while for the first early decades of the sport.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And when did women, I guess, sort of get more of their fair share of that pie?
It starts right away. I mean, there are continued challenges to that sort of rule in bicycling, but not until the 1890s with the safety frame, the similar technology that Sanger is riding, do they really become one of the key demographics in early cycling.
And as far as Walter Sanger goes, how long did his career last and what happened to him?
He's active in that 1890s period of the bicycle boom. But like many people, he starts to get distracted with the new technologies coming up. He kind of wanes in his career around 1896. He starts to lose a lot of major meets. He's still competing into the late 1890s. But like everybody else, he gets caught up in the automobile and motorcycle craze. He briefly races motorcycles around Milwaukee, but eventually settles down on the Upper East Side of Milwaukee and opens a little car dealership.
A car dealership? Yeah. I thought you were going to say a bike store.
No. All these guys, the manufacturers, the racers, they all transition over to automobiles by the early 1900s.
Do you think we still remember him? I mean, we're talking about him now on the radio, but is he still remembered in Wisconsin as a pioneer and a guy that we should know about?
Not really. He had an unfortunate death. I mean, his obituary did make it in the newspaper, but he died on December 6, 1941. So the coverage is about Pearl Harbor in the Milwaukee paper. And he kind of, I mean, he's in there that day, but isn't really covered in detail. But in the 1960s, when the Wisconsin Sports Hall of Fame is created, he's in the first class inducted alongside Curly Lambeau. So at least during that period, people still remembered him as being that important to be in the first class and alongside one of Wisconsin's most iconic and famous sports figures.
I'm so glad to hear about him today. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jesse, thank you.
Thanks so much.
That was Nick Hoffman and Jesse Gant, co-authors of the book Wheel Fever, How Wisconsin Became a Great Bicycling State. They were with us to talk about Wisconsin legend Walter Sanger.